The truth is that starting small and gradually expanding is what most businesses actually do, and they survive. The truth is that by starting small and gradually expanding, you lower risk and minimize the size of the mistakes you will make. The line of credit myth. I often hear that a line of credit is needed to cover cash flow fluctuations. My business is seasonal or unpredictable, so I have to have a line of credit to make it. Once again, the truth is very different from the mythology that the culture believes. The longer you are open, the more you should be able to predict normal cash flow fluctuations with decent accounting and budgeting. If you are smart and run your business well, you will catch on quickly to what cash drains are due to seasonal or cycle-caused problems. Also, when you have some retained earnings and or just some liquid cash, you become your own line of credit. Credit card debt in business. It is really hard to imagine, but people actually think using a credit card to finance a business is smart. The person who thinks that is a very naive business person, basically a gambler. Yet, according to Business Week, 50% of small companies use credit cards, with 71% of them carrying balances. This extremely expensive form of debt is an indicator that the person running or opening the business isn't putting much thought into the finances. They are under the illusion that they can out-earn their stupidity. As I have counseled small business people, I have found in most instances the credit card user is reactive. They are reacting to a slow time or an opportunity, or worse yet, they did not think through their launch very well and are reacting in the fashion of a dreamer thinking automatically it will all work out. I am convinced the failure rate of small businesses is largely influenced by the number of them who break the back of their dream by using credit cards to finance their business. I also counseled people who rationalize the use of credit cards in the operation of their business by saying, "We don't carry debt," or "We use them to do our accounting." First, if you don't carry debt, then use business debit cards. We use debit cards exclusively, and we find we watch them 1,000 times more closely because they represent real money. Lastly, if your only accounting system is your corporate credit card, you are an inept business person, and you must do some work to put a real accounting system in place. I know credit card companies sell the accounting function as one of the supposed benefits of using their plastic. But if you stop and think for one moment, you will realize how lame that is. Myth. Large purchases require debt. I've seen medium-sized businesses borrow $500,000 to buy equipment they could rent to stay ahead of the competition or to land that big job they think they couldn't do without the large purchase. Most business leaders are optimists, and so they often only see and digest emotionally that everything is going to work exactly as projected. I have had the displeasure of sitting with thousands of business people who hit the wall, and the big purchase that was financed was the reason for their failure rather than the reason for their success. I suggest you don't borrow for these large purchases for many of the reasons we have already discussed. Risk is increased exponentially, mistakes are magnified, and cash flow is destroyed by debt payments. You might ask, how in the world am I supposed to grow my business if I don't buy this equipment or this building? First, let me remind you that slow and steady wins the race, so it is preferable to grow slowly and gradually rather than go deeply into debt. There are four principles we follow when making large purchases. One, we pay cash. We systematically save toward a purchase goal and put that very specific amount as a line item in our monthly accounting, almost as if it were an expense. Saving is not tax deductible, but I still treat it emotionally and mathematically like it is an expense. So save $28,000 a month for 18 months, and you can pay cash for that $500,000 piece of equipment. Note, if you can't save the money, you won't be able to make the payments anyway. And don't think you will make the payment with the increased income, because it doesn't always happen like you plan. Two, we rent until we can pay cash. When I started my business in my living room, I didn't have a copier, so I rented one from Kinko's by paying per copy. Rent until you are so profitable you can afford to purchase with cash, and by then, you may not even want to own the stuff. I have a wonderful TV and radio studio with about $500,000 worth of equipment in it. We did not start there, however. We started in radio using the studio of the local station I was broadcasting on. That means that for 4 years, I drove across town every day to do a radio show. It was a pain. But during that time, I learned a lot about equipment, which meant when I did purchase, I didn't make mistakes. And of course, I didn't have debt payments on equipment driving me to make bad decisions out of desperation. Number three, we outsource to avoid going into debt. We purchase well over $10 million a year in printing and don't own a single printing press. We purchase meals for our team every week and provide catering for monthly events in our conference center, and we don't have a chef. It makes more sense to outsource economically from a management perspective and to avoid debt. After you have been in business at least 5 years and your growth is predictable, you might be ready to save and purchase something with cash. As I mentioned earlier, I got a great deal on the building we are in, but the repairs and operational functions some days cause me to be a landlord to myself instead of concentrating on what makes me money, my business. If I have to review bids to put a new roof on the building I own, that is not a revenue-producing activity. There is something to be said for letting a landlord be in the real estate business and letting you focus on your business. Once you have the money and are not going to quickly outgrow your purchase, then you may want to consider buying a building if you get a great deal. Otherwise, it is okay to rent the entire time you are in business. Number four. We buy used. When we started out and when we purchased our first big items, we purchased high-quality, used stuff that was pennies on the dollar. Great deals. The very first counseling table had very nice steel case brand chairs with it that were probably $400 new. But I bought used for $10 each, though they were an ugly green. We just needed something presentable and functional to start with. I think we still have that table, but the chairs are long gone. We don't buy used things like that today, but those purchases now represent a small portion of our revenues. Don't be so proud you can't or won't start with used equipment. Saving makes the world go round. On Mondays mid-morning, we have a leadership meeting of my top four leaders. In the first few years of the business, we called it the manager's meeting, and we discussed every detail going on in the business. We'd talk about personnel issues, cash position, purchases, technology, and anything else we needed to look at to keep the business running. There are three very important things I have applied the wisdom of the wife to. One is hiring, as I described earlier. Two is large decisions, like the time my wife Sharon got me to move into the building we are in. And three is the manager's meetings, which in the early days Sharon attended. She didn't want to come and honestly was quiet most of the time. We would sit and try to figure out what phone system to purchase, and she would yawn. She does not attend those meetings today because they got to be just too much. But her wisdom in those early days is legendary in our company culture. One Monday, we were whining. I know you never whine, but we were sitting in our manager's meeting whining. We were whining about how tight the money was and how it seemed we would never get over the top. We were whining about the fact that if we didn't collect from some of our customers, we were going to have a hard time meeting payroll on Friday. We were having a full-on pity party about how tough business was. My wife spoke up and said, "I know why you don't have any money." I kind of rolled my eyes and asked my wife, the homemaker, to enlighten us. She said, the reason you don't have any money is you guys are hypocrites. Then I was getting mad. But I said, okay, what are you talking about? You go on the radio and books and all over the country and seminars telling people to have an emergency fund, and yet you don't have one in the business, she said. Oh, crud. She was right. I hate that. I immediately knew that she was applying common sense and was saying that we didn't have any retained earnings. When you can't see the forest for the trees, it is always handy to have a lumberjack around. That month and every month since, we put a percentage of our net profits aside as retained earnings. Proverbs says, in the house of the wise are stores of choice food and oil. In other words, wise people save money. To this day, the retained earnings account is nicknamed the Sharon Fund, because that is actually how it got started. Retained earnings are used for three things: emergencies, investing into the business, and capitalizing on opportunities. The goal should be to have about 6 months of operating capital saved in cash. You likely aren't there now, and it will take you a while to achieve this much in retained earnings. But it is a great best-case scenario goal. It is not simply an emergency fund, but that would be the retained earnings' most important function. When you have built some liquidity, saved cash, your business can weather the storm. It is wise to expect the unexpected loss in revenue or increased expense. That way, you will stay open and operate with a ton less stress. Investing in your favorite company. Retained earnings are used for more than just the emergency fund. You can also grow your company without debt by simply designating some of your cash for future growth. You can launch a new product or hire some very talented people or try a new marketing approach when you have the money. When you do so with your hard-earned cash, you will be much more careful and wise with any growth-oriented investment than you will be with borrowed money. Borrowed money just doesn't feel real. Opportunity is knocking. The other thing cash is good for is to take advantage of huge opportunities that come along. You can buy inventory for pennies on the dollar off a failing vendor. You can buy out a competitor completely with cash for pennies on the dollar. For me, opportunity is spelled D-E-A-L, deal. Sometimes bargains of all kinds float before your nose, and you can't jump on them unless you have the cash. In the late 90s, we were providing content for a financial website startup during the dot-com boom. The startup was a classic dot-com deal. They were using venture capital to build an idea to take public. The idea was burning cash at an unbelievable rate and had yet to take in a dime of revenue. You know the story. They didn't make it. The guy running it called to tell us he was closing and we should buy out their brand new office furniture. My leaders and I discussed it and tried to figure out at what price we'd be stupid not to take the furniture. We decided $21,000 was a comfortable figure considering our cash position, especially since we were just going to store the stuff until we needed it. He took our low offer, so we bought that furniture at about 7 cents on the dollar. You can't, or at least shouldn't, do that unless you have the cash. When opportunity knocks, if you keep some cash, you can answer the door. Be generous. Being generous is the hallmark of people who live successful lives and who operate business with soul. If your exclusive reason for operating your business is personal gain, you will find yourself empty because you are shallow. Some of the greatest joys of becoming successful are associated with acts of generosity to your team, your customers, and your community. As an evangelical Christian, I believe in tithing on my income, which means Sharon and I give a tenth of our personal income to our local church. We do not find it in the Bible to tithe on business profits until we take them home. So we do almost no giving directly from our business. We take the profits and income from the business home where we tithe and do other giving. Giving from home keeps us from giving from the business as a form of advertising how wonderful we are. The math is the same when you tithe and give from home, but it keeps our motives more pure and allows us much more anonymity as well. In our case, we use a family foundation to keep all this separate. However, while we do most all of our cash giving from home, we maintain a generous spirit in our business. We want to be generous to our team, donate books to silent auctions, those types of things. If you are a dentist, your team should have free dental care for their immediate family. If you own a tire store, your team should not be riding on bald tires. Allocate money in your accounting process to constantly push a spirit of generosity. You will find the dividends in terms of smiles and personal satisfaction far outweigh the few dollars committed. Applying the principles. You might now be wondering what to do first and how to apply some of these principles. Most are obvious, like you have to do a better job than you have been doing with accounting, including developing an accurate budget. Simply stop buying things you don't need to make a profit or that are purchased exclusively to save on taxes. If you find your business in debt or without enough retained earnings, follow my suggested formula. First, drop your personal income from the business down to a simple living wage, the minimum your family can live on. Then apply most of the profits that are left after you pay yourself that living wage to debt reduction and use some smaller percentage to grow cash. I recently had an attendee at one of our Entree Leadership events who was running a nice printing business. He was making a profit of about $200,000 per year and took it all home, so he had no cash in the business and had equipment debt of $150,000. We counseled him to cut his take-home pay to $60,000 a year. Ouch! And he decided to apply 80% of profits to debt and 20% to cash reserves. If his business continues like it has, he will apply $112,000 to debt per year, making him debt-free in 17 months, and will also have saved $40,000 in cash by then. At that point, he can bring more home, and he decided to continue to grow cash at 20% of net profits until he has 6 months of operating capital. Wrap up. It sounds so primitive and unsophisticated when I state it again, but business is really not that hard. You are, however, required to do the basics or you will not win. Budget and do the accounting. Stay out of debt. Don't buy what is not needed to make a profit. Save cash and always be generous. When you do these basics with a steady hand and increasing sophistication, you will find yourself running a stable and satisfying operation. The map to the party. Grasping the undeniable relationship between great communication and great companies. When I was in college, my grandparents allowed me to live in their summer lake house for free. Get this, college student on the lake and it's free. The only drawback was that it was 27 miles from campus, and not an easy 27 miles. This particular stretch included cattle crossings, curves, 12 turns, country lanes, and all kinds of wildlife. Every commute was an adventure. Being in college and being on the lake meant that we were required by federal law to have frequent parties at the Ramsey Lake House. Before the days of the internet, cell phones, and GPS, we were required to learn the art of giving directions. The directions to these parties were a sheet of paper with a crudely drawn map that resembled a treasure map and a list of directions. Statements like, when you cross the railroad tracks, you will see a road to your right. Don't turn there. We were famous for our maps. The parties were awesome, but the trips to and from the lake house by first-timers created real legends. Getting lost is one thing, but getting lost in backwoods Tennessee and being really late for the party is another. Over the years, the number of times I have gotten to a party late and been really mad because of bad directions or no directions is ridiculous. Just this week, we had a dinner party at our home, and the guest's GPS sent them 10 miles out of the way, so we ended up talking them into our home by cell phone, and they were 30 minutes late. All was well, but it reminded me again how frustrating, even maddening, bad or no directions to the party are. Your business is a party. You have invited your team to the party. If you give really good directions, everyone will have a great time at the party. If your business is like most businesses, you are awful at the art of giving directions, and the only communication is poor communication. Communication in a business is the map to the party. If you have a great map, expect to have a great party. But most don't. One of the hallmarks of winning companies is they are very intentional and effective at communication. As a matter of fact, the entree leader's goal should be to create a company culture of communication. Communication is the grease in the gears. You can have great gears in your company, and it will still freeze up, grind to a halt, if you don't put the grease of communication into the engine. When the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing, great frustration and distrust sets in. Lack of communication is caused by many things, but there are two main reasons for it. One, companies don't make communication a priority. And two, leadership is so arrogant or fearful that they intentionally under-communicate. In either case, the lack of communication starts to sow the seeds of discontent and distrust within the team. If you want to create a company that is fun to work for, where productivity and creativity are high, that you are actually glad to lead, you must create a culture of communication. Many companies use mushroom communication with their team. Keep them in the dark and feed them manure. This is really short-sighted, and it has catastrophic results when it comes to trying to create an environment that attracts and retains talent, is creative and productive, and allows you to confidently delegate. When the team doesn't know what's going on in the company, they are, by definition, not a team. So you end up with employees, not team members. When the team doesn't know what's going on, fear and anger set in. When people don't know the truth, they generally will grow a huge pile of negative garbage in their minds that is 10 times worse than reality. Fear, frustration, anger, and distrust become the company culture when there is poor communication. That all leads to a culture of secrets, gossip, and tons of missed opportunities. Sadly, this describes most companies. If you are the kind of leader who has poor communication because you are not proactive about it, I can help you quickly change your company culture with some basic processes to create quality communication. The main thing that will change your company is your commitment to create a culture of communication. You must really want the left hand to know what the right hand is doing. Share the dream, tell the story. Your team can't manage their time toward building your dream if you don't tell them what the dream is. Communication moves the ball for the whole team, from dreams all the way into time management, which means productivity. Leadership has to repeatedly share the dreams, visions, mission statements, and goals with their team. As a leader, if you are not sick and tired of saying the same thing over and over and over, you have likely not communicated with your team. As a leader, you must learn to tell the story of your company and its history. As you tell the story of struggle and victories to your team over and over, you are accomplishing many things, such as teaching the team the value system of your company as they see how you reacted rightly or wrongly in a given situation in the old days. You will also let them know they are part of something that is bigger than them. If your team members know they are participating in a big deal, it gives them energy and creativity, as well as lets the occasional prima donna know you can probably pull this off without him if he doesn't plug into the culture. I often tell stories to our staff meeting of victories won in battles past. I always remind the existing team they are valuable, but the future is ours. The future is ours based on how we have won in the past. I recently held up a British pound and read the inscription around the edge of the coin, which says, "Standing on the shoulders of giants." I then went on to tell of the sacrifices and effort put out by some of our team members who have been with me for decades. I wanted all the great young talent to get the message that we will win. They are important, but standing in their midst are great warriors of old, so they should be respectful. Communication in times of trouble. Trouble is going to come to you. Trouble is going to come to your company. No one is exempt. So deciding how to communicate about it before it comes is absolutely vital. People who have emotional and spiritual maturity, as well as good mental health, can handle problems and can communicate during a crisis. When there is garbage to deal with, it might be the most important time you communicate with your team. We use a couple of rules when we are dealing with garbage. First, when in doubt, overshare. Tell more details and more of the story than you are really comfortable doing. This is risky and must be done with class and a warning. I have had to do this several times over the years, and I always start with a disclaimer. I let our team know that I am oversharing, and I have an expectation that they will be mature enough to hold this sensitive information. I remind them that we have a no-gossip policy, so if they have any comments or questions, they should bring them to leadership or keep them to themselves. I remind the team that we want to be a special company with high levels of communication, and I am honoring that by oversharing. And their part is to be emotionally mature enough to honor the process by acting like classy adults. Oversharing scares me, but having a normal company scares me even more. Second, never publicly harm or embarrass people while oversharing about problems. Several times over the years, I've had to deal with guys getting addicted to porn on the internet. In the instances where we couldn't walk them into a place of healing, we had to let them leave our company. I have never named a person when discussing the subject with the team. However, I occasionally remind our team that people have left our company over the misuse of the internet. I remind them that the computers and email they use are owned by me, and they have no right to privacy when using my equipment. That sounds so controlling and offensive as I write it, but privacy isn't a big deal to people who are living a clean life and doing the right thing. Once you have decided that huge amounts of communication are going to be a priority for you and your team, then you have to use some basic methods to communicate. Remember that creating a spirit in your culture that yearns for and seeks communication is the only way you can really create a winning environment. Here are a few common ways of communicating with your team. Staff meetings. When we were first starting and reached the level of about 10 team members, we all got in a huge argument one day. The stress and the frustration boiled over, and it was not pretty. Once we cooled off, we sat down and dissected what had occurred. We figured out that we really did trust each other's competency and integrity. We figured out that we had some very passionate champions pushing to make sure their area won. We also figured out that the right hand, not knowing what the left hand was doing, caused us to distrust each other's competency, integrity, and even intent. That moment is when our staff meeting was born. We drove a stake in the ground and made 8:30 to 9:30 a.m. Monday morning a mandatory meeting for every member of our little band. Our first meetings were very primitive and simply consisted of each person saying what they worked on the week before and what they were working on the coming week. At least each of us knew what the other was doing. immediately, even at this very primitive stage, we began to see the frustration and distrust leave. We also started seeing something we didn't see coming. Synergy. When you know what battle your fellow warrior is fighting, you can often offer great insight and connections to your network and even join in the battle. None of that was happening. The loss of 1 hour a week of work time increased our productivity tremendously. The productivity went up due to the synergies created, but also because we all liked and respected each other more. So today, with over 300 team members, we still gather on Monday mornings. Each department leader is called on to share something good or bad going on with their area. We celebrate the victories together, and we mourn the losses together. We introduce new hires to the whole company and clap welcoming them. We talk about profits and sales. We read hate mail and brag letters recognizing awesome customer service internally or externally. We generally leave that room first thing every single Monday morning on the same page and pumped up for the week to come. On Wednesday morning, we meet again as a group for an hour. This is our devotional time when we have a local pastor, a motivational speaker, or even a big-time recording artist come and inspire our team. In addition to lifting us all up, it gives us another time to make company-wide announcements in person. These 2 hours of shutting down our company to make sure we are all singing from the same sheet of music has yielded tremendous results. There are a lot of reasons we have a fabulous culture. But if you were to interview and ask my team what they attribute it to, many of them will tell you they value these times together. If you are running a business, you must do physical group meetings as often as possible and reasonable. If you are a huge business, meet departmentally. If your team is spread out geographically, meet by internet and force a physical gathering at least a few times a year. Mail. Voicemail, email, and texting are efficient but dangerous ways to communicate to your team. They are efficient because you can fire off a quick message to one or more players. However, they are dangerous because body language and tone are missing. Nonverbal communication accounts for 80 to 90% of the message. When you forget this, you will engage in email fights with people. I am guilty of doing this, and it is stupid. Worse than fighting by email is fighting by email while hitting reply to all. Email seems very efficient, but the loss in meaning requires more meetings to correct the imperfect communication, so be careful. Weekly reports. When our company got large enough that I couldn't look over people's shoulders, I found myself wanting to know what they were all doing. I also wanted to make sure they were doing something. I started thinking that I would like to have each team member do a weekly report stating what they had done that week. But the instant I had that thought, I recoiled against myself as becoming corporate. Weekly report sounds like useless paperwork done by a drone in a cube that hates his job. Yuck. But I was teaching my team time management and goal setting, so I wanted to be able to verify that these things were happening. The more I thought about the weekly report idea, the more I realized that it wasn't the report that I hated. It was the fear that it would be corporate. So our weekly reports are not written to me. The team member does a one-page summary of their week, written to themselves. If you are on my team, you need to be the kind of person who wants to win and measure yourself to make sure you win. What is the point of losing weight if you don't get on a scale to prove it? So each week, our team writes a report to themselves, answering the question, why should Dave be glad I work here? The report must be no longer than one page. At the top of the report is what I pay them, and they spend the rest of the page describing why I should be glad of that. Each report must contain the high point of the week and the low point of the week. When I first asked our team to do this, I was so naive, I assumed that the high and low points would have something to do with our business, their job. Nope. Our team members put some of the most bizarre personal information there you can imagine. I was tempted to go back to them in staff meeting and tell them to confine their highs and lows to business. But then I began to realize all this insight into where their head was is valuable for building relationships and leading them well. If the high point of the week is going to my first NFL football game of my life this weekend, thanks for the tickets, what did I find out? First, I need to see that person for 30 seconds as we leave staff meeting and talk football and find out how the game went. Second, my human resources guys who arranged for us to purchase tickets to give away need some positive feedback because their program is touching our team in a good way. Third, as a season ticket holder, I need to remember how many people consider something like that a huge deal. Perspective. All those conclusions from one little bit of communication. If the low point is, I am bummed that my dad didn't call me on my birthday, what did I find out? How that person's father issues have to be considered. Make double sure we do something cool for his birthday next year. Depending on my relationship or his leader's relationship with them, it might be appropriate to stop by his office and just give him a hug. My dog is sick. My mom is sick. I just got the biggest check of my whole life. I just got out of debt. I'm struggling with my marriage. I broke up with my boyfriend. I lost 32 pounds. I ran my first marathon. I love my job. Are just a few of the real life highs and lows I have read in reports. This stuff is extremely valuable because your team consists of people who have real people stuff going on all the time. I never asked them to get personal. They just did. Report musts. If you and your leaders do not read and react to the information in the reports, you are sending a message that communication and reports are not important. If you read a person has broken a sales record, give them a personal attaboy within minutes of reading the report. If there is a problem mentioned in the report, address the problem, but most importantly, let the writer of the report know you did. If you value the information you are getting, and you should, let the writer know it by acting on it. Read the reports and react to them every single week or don't do them. Key result areas. A job description is communication. When you state in writing clearly what the key result areas are for the position, you have communicated. KRAs are a vital type of communication because we have to continually define what winning looks like with our team. We are communicating that doing these three or four things with proper passion, creativity, and attitude is winning. If team members aren't doing them, they are losing, and they'd better change. That kind of communication is most often missing in companies. Management by walking around. There is no better quality of communication than in person. You have the benefit of body language, touch, tone, eye contact, plus a ton of other nonverbal cues that make communication complete. Tom Peters, in his wonderful book, In Search of Excellence, studied excellent companies to discover their attributes. I read the book decades ago and still remember several of the points. One thing that he mentions is MBWA, management by walking around. I like to think of it as simply hands-on leadership. The way I implement this type of communication is at least a couple of times a week I grab my cell phone and tell my assistant jokingly that I am going to walk through the building to spread hate and dissension. With my small yellow pad, I slowly walk through the building and feel what the vibe is. I use some of the highs and lows from reports to congratulate or console someone as I run into them. I look for dirt and disorganization. I eavesdrop on phone calls. Sometimes I just plop in front of someone's desk to find out about life and business from them. In 30 minutes, I can wander through our company and take its temperature. This is the culture of my company communicating with me. The feel in the air is communication. I have also deposited with my team by wandering through that I care and I don't live in an ivory tower. Sam Walton was known for riding with his delivery drivers and wandering through a Walmart spontaneously. Legend has it that he used to say he learned more about his company from truck drivers on a ride, checking out people on a visit, than his reports could tell him. He was communicating and being communicated with using MBWA. Conclusion. Chaos that is unhealthy and breeds failure happens in companies that don't make communication a big deal. Your team, by definition, can't be called a team unless they have a shared dream, vision, mission, and goals. The only way these things become shared is with intentional, quality, constant communication. Seth Godin says, a crowd is a tribe without a leader, without communication. My mandate to the Entree Leader is to lead the way, mechanically and culturally, creating quality communication. People matter most. Building unity and loyalty with your best resource. My personal assistant is tough as nails. So when I looked up from my desk and she was standing in my door with tears running down her face and a highway patrolman standing next to her, my stomach went into my throat. In an instant, I was worried about my wife and my kids. What in the world was happening? It is amazing how fast your mind can process situations and visual stimuli like that. The patrolman said he was there to deliver some really bad news. There had been an accident, a head-on collision, which took the life of a young mother and her little girl. Only the younger child, a baby, had survived. This was the family of a young man who worked for me. We asked the officer if we could tell him, which he said was fine, but he needed to be there to make sure the sad news had been delivered. My heart was beating wildly and my head was spinning. How in the world can you tell a young man that his wife and child are gone? I could hardly breathe. We sent word up to his department for him to come to my office, and that was when we discovered that he wasn't in the building. Where was he? Man, this was getting messy. Finding his leader, we figured out he was working with our live events crew that week, and so he was over 100 miles away setting up in an arena. Because the wreck was so big, it was going to play on the evening news, so the officer was insistent the young man get the news very soon. We chartered a jet to go pick him up and got it in the air in a matter of minutes, so that by the time we could get a hold of our young man, the jet was almost there. We called a leader on site and had him plus a few others gather in a hotel room with our young husband. Sadly, we had to deliver this horrible news over the phone, but then sent him straight to the airport with a leader riding the jet home with him for comfort. We got his family and pastor to meet the jet as it landed, so he had as many people as possible who loved him around him in that horrible time of need. That was one of the toughest days of leadership that I can ever recall. How did we make decisions quickly and wisely in such a stressful situation? How did we know what to do in that wild crisis without hesitation? Simple. We handle all of our interactions with our team in any situation based on one simple rule, the golden rule. I know I've mentioned this before, but you have to learn to treat other people like you would want to be treated if you want to build loyalty and unity in your company. I knew exactly what to do, everything within my power to minimize the extreme pain that life had brought to our young husband. Leading for loyalty. Do you know why most employees aren't loyal to their company and leadership? Because their company and leadership aren't loyal to them. My wife always told my children growing up that if you want to have friends, you have to be a friend. If you want loyalty, you have to be loyal. Too many people in business have abandoned sight of the fact that their team members are humans. They are people. Too many people in business have become so shallow that they are merely transactional, not relational. The people on your payroll are not units of production. They are people. They have dreams, goals, hurts, and crises. If you trample them or don't bother to engage them relationally, you will forever struggle in your operations. Treat others as you want to be treated is a core entree leadership principle. When you would expect to be praised, praise. When you would expect a raise, give a raise. When you would need training, train. When you would need some grace, give some grace. When you would expect a reprimand, give one. When you would feel competent and want the dignity of being left to do the job, back off and let the competent execute. Quality people, really all people, have a need to be treated with dignity. If you want your team to buy into your dream and execute with every ounce of passion they have, you must be caught caring about them personally and treating them with dignity. We hired a superstar marketing guy to reel in some large relationships. We clearly defined his key results areas and set up his compensation so that when he landed a whale or two, he would make some great money. About 6 months into his employment, he brought in a $1 million deal. He got creative with a client who was nibbling and sold them on something completely outside of what we hired him for. We realized, and so did he, after the deal was signed, that his compensation structure specifically said he would not be paid on deals outside his area. The decision was made instantly to pay him anyway. This poor guy had been in bad companies for so long, he had become cynical and could not believe that some company would actually pay him money that was not technically due. He cried when he opened his check. It was awesome. We made that decision instantly. How? That is what I would want someone to do for me if I brought them a $1 million deal. Do you think this guy is pumped? Sure. Do you think this guy will be loyal? Of course. Do you think anyone anywhere anytime can say something bad about me within earshot of him and not have a fight on their hands? Loyalty. Possibly best of all, he will be motivated, highly motivated, to bring in some more $1 million deals because he knows I have his back. He will be paid. Sadly, some short-sighted companies do the exact opposite. They save the money they would have paid him, but lose his trust, loyalty, motivation, and creativity. All that loss for a saved commission check is really bad business. Fanatical integrity. Loyalty comes also from fanatical integrity. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. When you commit to pay someone, pay them. Never miss payroll. You'd do better to lay people off if your company is struggling than to have them work there and their checks not clear. Tell the truth in tough times and in good times. Be transparent about how decisions are made and what the team is facing. Don't cut pay when someone is producing. You will cause them to dislike producing. A company cannot attract and keep quality, talented people when you mistreat them and those around them. Integrity also means consistency. If you react the same way every time in every similar situation, you don't have to put your company values in a brochure because your team sees them lived every day. The more predictable you become on matters of principle, values, and culture, the more you grow leaders and team members who you can delegate to. You can delegate to them because they will know what to do by watching your consistency. Loyalty is born, and a quality culture occurs when the entree leader follows through in a predictable, positive, and proactive manner on every issue and opportunity. People only allow themselves to be led when they feel valued and when they are treated with dignity. Know your team. Know their kids' names, their wives' names, and their dreams. Find out their story. Everyone has one. Visit the funeral home, the hospital, and never miss a birth. When you have the power or the connections or the money to help them live their lives better, always do it. None of us gets to the end of our lives and think we should have done one more deal or made one more dollar. When your life draws to a close, you realize what is important. People and how you treated them. Your team is watching, and just like your children, they would rather see a sermon than hear one anytime. Unity. One of the largest, strongest horses in the world is the Belgian draft horse. Competitions are held to see which horse can pull the most, and one Belgian can pull about 8,000 pounds. The weird thing is, if you put two Belgian horses in the harness who are strangers to each other, together they can pull 20 to 24,000 pounds. Two can pull not twice as much as one, but three times as much as one. This example represents the power of synergy. However, if the two horses are raised and trained together, they learn to pull and think as one. The trained and therefore unified pair can pull not only 24,000 pounds, but will hit 30 to 32,000 pounds. The unified pair can pull four times as much as a single horse. They can pull an extra 8,000 pounds simply by being unified. But unity is never simple or easy. There are numerous examples from the basketball court or the football field of superstars who are jerks and bring disunity to a team due to their self-centeredness. A group of superstars is seldom a dream team in sports. It usually looks more like a large daycare with temper fits and messes. Most sports fans and most athletes yearn to watch and play with the unselfish player. It is amazing how a well-coached team of unified B-level players will often beat the big names if the big names don't have unity. In business, we often make the same mistake. We can mistakenly believe that if we just hire talented people, we will win at business. So some companies gather a group of talented people, and among them are several jerks. Because there are some jerks in the bunch, no one wants to pull together. And the disunity more than offsets what the talent brings. And together they lose. I would rather have a group of passionate, unified B and C players than a group of disgruntled superstars. My little band of highly unified folks will win almost every time. Five enemies of unity. As I have fought to build unity in our team, I have discovered the hard way what destroys unity. I have found that if we keep these five enemies of unity away from the gate of our company, we become increasingly unified. Unity brings us a great work environment where productivity, customer service, creativity, and the resulting profit more naturally occur. Number one. Poor communication. Poor communication causes a lack of unity. This is so important that we spent the whole last chapter on it. To recap, if the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing, disunity, anger, and frustration will fill your company. A team is only a team by definition when they are unified. They are on the same page. If you want a fabulously unified team and all the good stuff that brings, you will have to work unbelievably hard to create and maintain high levels of communication. Number two, lack of shared purpose. Lack of shared purpose causes a lack of unity. If the team doesn't share the goals of leadership and of each other, there isn't unity. Again, this is so important that I opened the book with dreams that lead into vision, into mission, and into goals. Shared goals create unity. There is no unity where there isn't a common goal, a common mission, a common vision flowing from a common dream. If you want a fabulously unified team and all the good stuff that brings, you will have to work unbelievably hard to create a common vision and goals. Number three, gossip. I can't stand gossip. I have done it, and I have seen people do it. And gossip is gross. In a company culture, gossip will destroy all the good things you work so hard to create. There is no possible way you can have unity with a group of gossips. The very nature of gossip is the opposite of unity. Instead of pulling people together, gossip pushes them apart. Everyone knows inherently they can't trust a gossip. I hate gossip so badly that after putting up with it at the start, I decided to have a no-gossip policy in our company. You are not allowed to gossip and work for me. If one of my leaders or I catch a team member gossiping, we will warn them once, then we will fire them. Yes, I have actually fired people for gossiping, and I will again. Gossip is evil, it is insidious, and it is contagious. Stamp out gossip if you want unity. Proverbs says, whoever guards his mouth and tongue keeps his soul from troubles. Problems or gripes are fine, but they must be handed up to leadership. Problems or gripes that are handed down or laterally are by definition gossip and run the team member the risk of being fired. We had a man who was constantly struggling with his leader. They clashed and both were talented. He made the mistake of sharing his frustrations with the sales support person in the group. We warned him once, and then he decided to share with two other people, so he doesn't work on our team anymore. The sales support person can't do anything to help him with his frustration, so that is gossip. Hand your negatives up and your positives down. Otherwise, it starts to sound a lot like gossip. Number four, unresolved disagreements. When some of your team members have a disagreement, it has to be resolved. Unresolved disagreements paralyze people. There are particular levels of maturity and some personality styles who can't stand conflict. Conflict is debilitating to them, and it must be resolved. Conflicts that remain unresolved grow and kill unity. Unresolved disagreements remain unresolved when the entree leader doesn't know they exist. Teach your team to either resolve conflict or openly talk about it with leadership so they can get some help solving the problem. One of the beauties of the high and low points on the weekly reports is conflicts will show up there, giving you the opportunity to help solve the problem. One week when I was reviewing the team's weekly reports, I saw that one of our sales support ladies had as her low point, quote, I hate it when people talk down to me, unquote. My first thought was, oh, grow a backbone and get over it. But then I started to think about what she was really saying. She was really asking for help. So I had her leader check it out. It turns out that this young lady who was pregnant was upset about a comment a 50-something coworker who was having a bad day had made to her. Let's see, a pregnant woman and a lady in her mid-50s. No hormones involved here, right? We sat them both down. The older lady apologized. They both cried, and they went on to become great friends, with the older lady even mentoring the new mother for many years. That only happened because leadership stepped in and didn't let an innocent disagreement go unresolved. I don't require everyone on my team to like each other or be best friends off campus. But I do require they respect each other and agree that while styles may be different, we have shared integrity and shared intent. We will sit and talk until we can get to that point. Sometimes disagreements are unresolved because leadership is chicken or doesn't want to be bothered by the drama. Part of leading a team is helping them grow together. Otherwise, they will grow apart. Entree leaders must have the courage to deal with conflict and must bother with the drama. Number five, sanctioned incompetence. John Maxwell says, sanctioned incompetence demoralizes. When a team member is incompetent, for whatever reason, and leadership won't act, the good team members become demoralized. Why should I work hard if he doesn't have to? Becomes the prevailing thought in the whole company. Team members who are motivated will become the exception rather than the rule if you tolerate misbehavior. Team members will often take their direction from the way you treat other team members. I have struggled between being kind to people, giving them every chance to turn their performance around, and on the other hand, letting their lack of performance spread through the whole place. I had an assistant in the company who was just never going to get where she needed to be. She just didn't have the mental tool set to rise to where she could perform with excellence in her role. However, she was one of the nicest people I've ever met. Everyone loved her and wanted to see her win because she was so well loved.